I can't even tell if it's there. I know. The logical thing is to go tell somebody. But Mom, Dad, here's the thing. They can't do anything about it if I have smallpox now. Derek's favorite topic is, what lunatic sent anthrax through the mail? But if I send smallpox through New York, I'm not a lunatic. I'm a mass murderer who knew exactly what was going to happen. I'm no different from those 19 murderers who drove their planes into us on September 11. And even if I got hospitalized in time, and even if nobody else caught smallpox, and even if they kept the virus limited to my body and my room, variola major would exist again. You wouldn't believe these scientists who want to keep smallpox around. They want to combine smallpox with monkeypox or whatever, just to see what happens. I can't do anything about the virus the CDC has locked up, but I can keep it from existing in actual society. I've been thinking about that word, society. It means all of us in New York, every age, race, job, weight, and religion. Every time we laugh or sing, ride the elevator, buy a coffee, go to the theater, eat in a restaurant, jog in the park. We're society. I don't want to be the Typhoid Mary of my society. You have all these great plans for my future, but what if my future is to be smallpox MIDI? Don't laugh. I'm not laughing. Here's what I'm thinking. If this is a live virus, and it's the only one in the entire world, I should not let it live. And if I have it, and if I let the world hospitalize me, I let the virus out into society. I give it life. There is only one way to be sure I don't give anybody this disease. There is only one way to be sure that no ambulance driver, no doctor, no mother, no father, no classmate, no kid in a stroller, no guy on a bike, no waiter in a diner, not one person in New York gets sick from me. That way is to die before I get sick. Then the virus dies with me. Chapter 11.
Guess what MIDI has agreed to write about, Mrs. Abrams said to the class. Monsters! Mythical and biological! Isn't that brilliant?
Actually, it seemed weird, and maybe even meaningless. But nobody said anything. They all knew MIDI had not agreed. He had been railroaded.
Building on your biology project is so wise of you, MIDI, Mrs. Abrams told him.
MIDI smiled politely. He could hardly hear her. His thoughts were thundering in his head, like the bass on the stereo turned all the way up. It would be easy enough to die. He'd just get up in the night and leave the apartment building by the back door and nobody would see him go, because there was nobody on duty at the back during the night. You could always get out of a building, because of fire laws. But you couldn't always get in, because of safety laws. Walk a few blocks up, a few blocks over, and there was the Hudson River. Step in, start swimming, and soon enough the cold and the current would win. But could he do that to his parents? MIDI believed suicide was the most vicious thing a child could do to his mother and father. It was saying, "You don't matter enough to me to stay alive." It was saying, "I hate you so much, I'm going to make you think about my dead body every day of your life." But MIDI would be doing this for the opposite reason. He'd be saying, "You and the world matter so much, I can't let you be exposed to disease." But did that justify it?
MIDI?
MIDI roused himself. They were in the library again. He could tell by all those rows of books. "Hi, Mr. Lynch, how are you?"
"Worrying about you. Come on, MIDI, make an effort."
"I'm all efforted out."
"You are off to such a great start. How about an interview? Have you tried to get one yet?"
"Yes," MIDI said slowly.
"And?"
MIDI felt disconnected. Eventually, he said, "Nobody wrote back."
"You just don't know the right people, MIDI," said Nate. "My father knows everyone. I can help you."
MIDI would rather get smallpox. The principal did not call MIDI to his office. The secretary did not summon him to the phone. The FBI did not spring into the classroom. The choice was still MIDI's. MIDI had not frequently observed acts of personal physical courage. Sure, in action films or on TV, but in real life in America, who exhibited physical courage? Only in extreme circumstances, or faked ones on TV, did the need for courage arise. Nobody in the city had to face the wilderness or a panther. Your problems were a full parking lot or final exams. Even if true danger was coming, like a hurricane, you just bought your extra quart of milk and watched it on television. In fact, Mitty could think of only two current examples of people walking into true danger and fighting back: the firefighters and police officers of 9/11, and the soldiers sent to Afghanistan and Iraq. How vividly Mitty remembered a video of firefighters running into one of the towers. Young men trained to rescue the innocent, regardless of danger to themselves. The nation and Mitty stood in awe. But in everyday life, physical challenge consisted of inline skating on a paved path in a civilized park. Mental challenge consisted of counting carbohydrates. Moral challenge consisted of deciding whether to cheat on a quiz. "I still have time," he reminded himself. "I can delete my letter to my parents. I can call the hotline. Or shrug and tell myself nothing could happen." When school was out, he headed straight home. He had things to do. But Olivia caught up to him. She had an odd, fragile smile on her face. "Mitty?" she said, as if he might be somebody else entirely. He stopped walking. He hadn't wanted his parents near him. He didn't want Olivia near him either. "Let's walk in the park," she said. Mitty hesitated, thinking about it, and her face fell. It wasn't how he wanted to say goodbye. "Okay," he said finally. "It's pretty nice out," although it wasn't. Central Park. Magnificent trees and awesome views, unexpected sculptures and stunning skylines. What if he never saw Central Park again? For Olivia, more than anything, Central Park meant dogs. Everybody on the Upper West Side had babies in strollers or dogs on leashes or both. Olivia greeted every dog walker, knelt to rub every dog's ears, and told every dog how beautiful he was. Then she had to ask the dog's name and verify the dog's breed and, of course, discuss her own dogs. Olivia cuddled a Rhodesian Ridgeback and then a pair of blind white labs, a brace of bouncing long-haired Dachshunds, and finally a tall, proud shepherd. Mitty thought of Macaulay, who had written, "The smallpox was always present, filling the churchyards with corpses, tormenting with constant fears all whom it had not yet stricken, leaving on those whose lives it spared the hideous traces of its power, making the eyes and cheeks of a betrothed maiden objects of horror to the lover." Through the leafless trees, he could see the stone tower of the American Museum of Natural History. Infectious disease was natural history. "God, don't let me be a chapter in that kind of history," he thought. Olivia took his hand before he could stop her. They walked on together. Olivia swung his hand slightly. "Saturday is Valentine's Day." Mitty thought of what his Valentine's Day gift in New York City might be. He extricated his hand. Olivia's cheeks stained red and she blinked hard, looking away from him. He knew what it meant for a girl to mention Valentine's Day. He and Olivia were at the right stage for Valentine's Day, ready to be together, not for study and not for school, but for love. He did not want to touch her, even though that was the only thing he wanted. He looked at the bare trees. They would leaf out in spring. Would he be there to see them? Olivia waited for him to speak. He knew what she was really asking. "How much do we like each other?" "A lot," thought Mitty. But he didn't say anything. She took a step back from him and he ignored it. She turned and took one step in the opposite direction. He said nothing. Her shoulders slumped. He knew she was crying. She walked away. He let her go. Chapter 12. On Wednesday, February 11, Mitty Blake did not show up for school. Neither did Olivia Clark. Since Olivia had nearly perfect attendance and never skipped homework, never mind class, this was an interesting pair of absences.
"She has to be with Mitty," said Emma excitedly. "Maybe not," said Constance. "She could be sick."
"She's never sick," said Zora, who had first dibs on Olivia because the Clarks had stayed in her apartment right after September 11. Zora whipped out her cell phone and called Olivia. Olivia did not answer.
"I bet she told somebody," insisted Madeline. "Who knows what's happening?"
But Olivia had not called anybody. Derek found himself surrounded.
Well, demanded Zora, what's Mitty doing? Is he with Olivia?
Way to go, Mitty, thought Derek. He checked his phone for messages from Mitty, but there weren't any. This was not surprising. You didn't notify people when you skipped school. Derek headed to English, where Mrs. Abrams took attendance. The attendance secretary would now telephone the home of every student who hadn't shown up. If the parents had already called to say their kid was sick, or they were taking him skiing, the parent didn't get a call. But now and then the parent waved goodbye to the kid and left for work, while the kid sauntered right back into the apartment for a happy day of television. Such a parent wanted to know the score. Checking was done by phone, because any kid could compose and send an email that sounded as if it were from a parent. Derek figured the school would cut Mitty a little slack, because just the other day, when Mitty was late, his mother telephoned the office twice more during the day, as if Mitty might slither out a crack in the wall and skip afternoon classes, too. The office would dread phoning the Blakes only a few days later, because the thing about private school was, even something that was completely the kid's fault, the parents would say was the school's fault. Mrs. Abrams had left Beowulf behind and was forging on to a British poet named John Milton, who had written something called Paradise Lost. Derek's initial take on Paradise Lost was that he and Mitty wouldn't be reading this one either. When her classroom phone rang, Mrs. Abrams yelled irritably toward the speaker, "Yes?" "Is Derek Skorvenek there?" The class looked up. That was not the attendance secretary's voice, not the upper school secretary's voice. It was the headmaster. Dr. Larkin was interested in parents, not students, so this call was extraordinary. "Yes, he is," said Mrs. Abrams, regarding Derek with curiosity.
"Send him to my office immediately, please."
The class was delighted. Somebody was in serious trouble, and who better than Derek? Derek tried to look bored, but he left the room with his heart pounding. In spite of a reputation for stuff like hacking into corporate computers, Derek was all talk. He'd never done much of anything. He could think of no reason for Dr. Larkin's summons, except that something was wrong at home. Derek found his parents massively annoying, and tried never to associate with them, but still, he didn't want them having heart attacks. He walked slowly down the hall, as if the bad news might have worn off by the time he got there. But when he was ushered into the headmaster's office, two men Derek did not recognize wanted to know where Mitty was.
"Mitty?"
said Derek, as if these two syllables were unknown to him.
"Your best friend," Dr. Larkin reminded him.
Derek stared at the two guys. They stared back. Were these guys Olivia's uncles or something? Was she connected? And these guys were going to put cement around Mitty's feet and throw him into the Hudson? Derek tried to think of a way to protect Mitty.
"Derek, these gentlemen are from the FBI, said the headmaster.
It was all Derek could do not to hoot with laughter. Mitty would love this.
"We need to find Mitty now, said Dr. Larkin. He's missing.
He's not missing, said Derek. He just isn't here.
Derek pictured Mitty and Olivia having fun somewhere in New York. Presumably inside, it was pretty chilly for outdoor activity, and the FBI walking in on them. Mitty would laugh for years, but Olivia was not a big laugher in the best of circumstances. In fact, now that Derek thought about it, far from having a wild and crazy adventure, Mitty and Olivia were probably holed up in a library somewhere while Olivia was correcting Mitty's spelling.
"Do you know where he is, Derek?" asked Dr. Larkin.
"Nope."
"It's urgent," said the guy in the darker suit. His tie gleamed with a blue and silver iridescence, like spilled oil. Derek couldn't decide if he liked the tie or wanted to burn it.
"Since when is cutting class a national emergency?" Derek asked.
"This is not about school," said a woman behind Derek.
Derek spun around, expecting Mitty's mother. Mrs. Blake was just the type who would call in the FBI if her son missed a grand total of 1 hour of class. It wasn't Mrs. Blake. It was a much younger woman, quite hefty, wearing wool pants and a heavy blazer that did not become her. She was the exact shape of his own mother. This did not endear her to Derek. He scowled at her. The guy in the darker suit said to the headmaster, "Thank you, Dr. Larkin. We'll let you know when we're done." Dr. Larkin turned red. Derek expected him to argue, but instead, the headmaster obediently walked out of his own office, shut his own door, and left his student alone with the three strangers. What was up with this? The second FBI agent, whose suit was charcoal gray with red pinstripes, said, "Derek,
I'm Agent Anthony Finelli, and this is Agent McKay. We need your help. Mitty may be in trouble.
Trouble with the FBI? What did they think Mitty had been doing? Was Mitty doing it? How was Derek supposed to protect him?
Mitty didn't come home last night, Finelli told Derek. His parents usually talk to him on his cell phone every day after school. Yesterday afternoon, he never answered his phone. They called the NYPD around 7 p.m.
7 o'clock seemed pretty early to panic. Who would call the police because their 16-year-old was late for dinner? Well, actually, Mrs. Blake. But Mitty hadn't gone home at all? He'd been gone overnight? That was some serious hookup with Olivia. In fact, it didn't sound like either of them.
Mitty's parents didn't call me, Derek protested. They would have called me if they got worried.
Finelli shook his head. He was very spiffy. The triangular tips of a silk handkerchief poked up out of his jacket pocket. He had the lean, tight look of a runner.
There were other circumstances, he told Derek.
Like what?
Nobody answered. But Derek had a sense that they were not being difficult. They were just not willing to say out loud what needed to be said.
The woman spoke up. I am not with the FBI, Derek. I am with the CDC. What do you know about your friend Mitty's biology paper?
The FBI and the CDC wanted Mitty because of his term paper?
The paper Mitty was writing only so he could tag along with Olivia to her library of the week?
Derek dropped into a chair, beaten. He had failed in his mission. He had not found the murderer of Attili Lundgren. Mitty must have pulled it off. Mitty must have written to the FBI. That was so massively not fair.
Okay, who did it? Said Derek tiredly. Who killed her?
When the phone rang, Olivia knew it was St. Raphael's attendance secretary. She really was sick. She had a headache from crying all night about Mitty Blake. She, most sensible of girls, had stupidly become romantic. She had flung herself on Mitty, bringing him little gifts she shuddered to remember. Books on viruses? Books on epidemics? He's probably been laughing at me the whole time, she thought. He and Derek are probably sitting together right now, laughing themselves sick. Olivia had had Valentine's Day fantasies. In class, a few days before, when people like Emma had been asking silly questions, Olivia Clark had been writing a love limerick. The first four lines had been easy. It was the punchline she couldn't get right.
There once was a great guy named Mitty, the cutest and best in the city. For Olivia Clark, he felt quite a spark, and they something and something were...
Pretty? Gritty? Committee?
She knew she'd come up with a perfect ending for her Valentine's poem, and she'd present it to Mitty. Maybe in a frame. For his gift, Mitty would bring roses and a box of chocolates with soft centers. They would go to the Metropolitan Museum, which made a big deal about Valentine's Day, where he would have reserved a balcony table for two. But yesterday afternoon, she had dragged him to the park when it was perfectly clear he had other plans. Cuddled dogs when it was Mitty she wanted. She had taken his hand, which just lay in hers like an old newspaper. He didn't want her hand. He had peeled her off. He hadn't answered when she mentioned Valentine's Day. Olivia had turned away to hide an explosion of tears and found herself walking off. Surely he would follow her, grab her hand again, swing her in circles like in the library. But Mitty had not caught up. She could have turned around, gone back, called to him. But instead, she went silently home. He didn't call. He didn't IM or email either. And those were easy and impersonal. She woke up knowing she could not attend school. Nobody but Olivia would be surprised that Mitty had lost interest. All the girls had been sure she was not Mitty's type, and she couldn't face them with their I-told-you-so smirks. Worse, she would have to face Mitty. Now the phone rang a second time. If she let the answering system respond, the school would call her parents at work. Olivia had never mentioned Mitty to them. They had no idea that their daughter had flipped upside down and inside out over some boy. They were physicians, who liked to be at the hospital by 7. She could not stand to think of interrupting them in the midst of patient care. Olivia answered. But it was not the secretary. It was the headmaster. Derek was explaining his obsession with the murder of Attili Lundgren. It turned out the FBI guys were just as obsessed. They too had tracked recipients of anthrax mail and were frustrated by failure.
Can I read your files? Asked Derek excitedly. Can I get it classified stuff?
They were sympathetic, but not that sympathetic.
How were you thinking you could solve it? Asked McKay.
I believe the answer to everything is on the internet, said Derek. You just have to know where to look.
Did Mitty think that too?
Derek had practically forgotten Mitty and his excitement about anthrax murders.
I think Mitty was bored when I talked about anthrax, he said cautiously.
This isn't about anthrax. It's about Mitty's topic, smallpox. What do you know about the smallpox scabs Mitty has?
I don't even know what a smallpox scab is.
Did you ever touch them?
They would have been scabs like from a bad cut that he had in an old envelope.
Derek shook his head. He never showed me anything like that.
Mitty was offering them on the internet, said Finelli.
It was a lousy day when the FBI cared what you advertised on the internet. The headmaster's door was flung open. Olivia Clark stood there, breathless and windblown, her velvet jacket buttoned wrong, her hair unbrushed, her eyes red-rimmed.
Mitty wasn't with Olivia? Olivia had been homesick?
Derek felt a shiver of anxiety.
Where was Mitty?
In fact, Mitty rarely skipped or cut. He was the kind of boy who thought any place was better than school, but at the same time he didn't want to miss anything, so he was always here.
Miss Clark? The agents asked her, shutting the door carefully behind her.
What did Dr. Larkin mean you're from the FBI? What did he mean Mitty's missing? Olivia cried. He's cut school before. He's been late before. Missing seems like a very strong conclusion. What is your basis?
For the first time, Derek found Olivia attractive. Finelli said, You're Mitty's girlfriend? Olivia was belligerent.
Who says?
Go, Olivia, thought Derek. Talk back to the FBI.
According to your headmaster, Olivia, the whole school says so.
Finelli was smiling in a nice way, as if he remembered being 16 and in love, or had lots of practice setting hostile witnesses at ease.
When did you last see Mitty, Olivia?
Olivia folded her arms.
Prior to a discussion, I want to know what the discussion is about.
Her arms and chin were trembling. She looked to Derek for help. He had none to give.
How do you do, Miss Clark? Said the woman. I'm Dr. Barb Graham. I'm an epidemiologist with the CDC. This has to do with your biology papers. Your biology teacher and your headmaster believe that the three of you have been inseparable during your research, and that Mitty did most of his research, Miss Clark, with your help.
Olivia stared at her blankly.
Did you do the smallpox research together? Asked Dr. Graham.
Olivia was puzzled.
My project was typhoid fever, but I did do some work on smallpox. I was worried Mitty wouldn't bother, so I sort of pre-read books for him.
It struck Derek forcibly how polite Mitty had been about this. Derek would have been mental.
Did you pre-read any 100-year-old medical texts?
Of course not. Did you do any online research with Mitty?
Olivia shook her head.
We used books, current books, useful books. Did you see or touch any 100-year-old medical textbooks that Mitty's mother purchased for her decorating business? There were 4 altogether. I don't even know about them. In one of those books, Mitty found an old envelope that was filled with scabs of smallpox from a 1902 epidemic. Did he discuss these scabs with you?
Olivia shook her head.
Did he show them to you? No?
The scabs are infectious, aren't they? Said Derek, figuring it out. Mitty's going to get smallpox, isn't he?
Olivia backed against the wall, pressing her spine to the plaster as if it would keep her upright.
That's impossible, she whispered.
That's impossible, agreed Dr. Graham calmly.
The FBI agents were watching Dr. Graham as if they too wanted reassurance that it was impossible.
What are the odds that Mitty could get smallpox from those scabs? Derek asked her.
Virtually 100% impossible, said Dr. Graham.
But not actually 100% impossible? There's a chance?
Dr. Graham brushed away the thought with a hand gesture.
Infinitesimally small.
Then why were they here? Derek wanted to know. If the scabs were infectious and Mitty could get sick, of course they'd round up anybody who had touched the scabs. But if the scabs were not infectious and nobody could get sick, who cared? It was pretty heavy duty to bring not one but 2 FBI agents into this. Agents who had already coordinated their efforts with the CDC.
We need to find Mitty, said McKay. I'm going to let you read a letter he left on his laptop. It's written to his parents. His laptop was in his bedroom, not turned off, but sleeping, so when his mother touched a key, this material came up. We printed it out. Olivia and Derek read together. So, Mom, Dad, this is a letter. Olivia could not even hold the pages. She hurt from the soles of her feet to the core of her heart. Mitty had been thinking of suicide when she stood in the park next to him. Mitty had been thinking of death when Olivia played with puppies, when she asked about Valentine's Day. The extent to which she had not known Mitty Blake hit Olivia so hard that she could not see the words on the pages. She did not want these people near her. She wanted to go home and bawl. He didn't trust me, she thought. He didn't think I could handle such serious topics. And I didn't trust him either. I thought he was kind of shallow. And here he's deeper than I've ever been, and thinking about more profound things than I ever have. Could she be in this stupid office, with these stupid strangers, talking about stupid things when Mitty wasn't alive anymore? No, Mitty. Please say you didn't take your own life to save us. I would honor you forever, Mitty. But I don't want to honor your grave. I want you. No, said Derek flatly. He's not out there killing himself. There was this suicide in school last year, and we all had to write essays for English about teenage suicide. Mitty wrote that suicide is vicious. The teacher gave him a D. She said he was insensitive, and if somebody got overwhelmed, Mitty had to be understanding. Mitty said he understood that this kid intentionally destroyed his parents. He said a person of courage stuck it out. Mitty's not going to off himself. But he seems to address that very problem, said Finelli. He explains that his case is different, and presumably Mitty left his laptop open just so his parents would read this letter. Derek didn't believe it. Not Mitty. Mitty had too much fun in the world. He wouldn't quit. He remembered, with a certain horror, that Mitty's favorite band was Widespread Panic, his favorite album Ain't Life Grand, his favorite song, Heroes. Derek couldn't go there. He wouldn't. Mitty was alive, had to be alive. Wasn't there a movie where the guy vanished in the Rocky Mountains to live out his disease or die trying? That sounded like Mitty. If I were Mitty, thought Derek, where would I hole up? The agents wanted to know if either he or Olivia had seen Mitty after school the day before.
Mitty and I went for a walk in the park, said Olivia. I headed home around 4.
And what did Mitty do? Olivia seemed to crumple.
I don't know.
She accepted a tissue from Dr. Graham, mopped her eyes, and pulled herself together.
But I'll tell you my own conclusion. Nobody can get smallpox from century-old lesion material. And furthermore, the FBI and the CDC don't show up at a high school because a kid found useless dust. They don't come because a kid missed dinner or skipped class. They don't come because yet another teenager feels suicidal. You came because you think there's something to worry about. And you're federal agents, so you think it's a potential nationwide worry. What exactly is this nationwide worry?
They didn't answer.
A smallpox epidemic? She asked.
Nonsense, said Dr. Graham. Olivia closed her eyes, summoning facts from the depths of her mind.
As I recall, when mad cow disease appeared in Britain, the U.S. government made a decision not to allow a single American who had lived in Britain to donate blood, because they might have eaten contaminated meat and thus have bad blood, and so recipients of their blood might get sick. Yet there was not a single case of mad cow disease in the entire United States, let alone one transmitted from a person who had lived in Britain, let alone one from a blood donor. So in fact, the U.S. government in recent history made a huge decision to prevent a disease when there was not a scrap of evidence to verify that there was a scrap of risk. Is this the same thing? Contracting smallpox is virtually 100% impossible, but you're still worried, in fact desperate, and you've got to find the one person who might have it.
Derek was thinking in another direction, drawing on 2 years of studying the anthrax letters. He said,
when he went online, was Mitty offering his smallpox scabs for sale or asking for information or what?
He stated that he had recently found them and was anybody interested in them. A thrill of understanding raced through Derek Skorvenik.
This isn't about getting sick, is it? It's about getting on the internet. Mitty got on the internet and everybody else is there too. Everybody, good and bad, sane and insane, individuals, groups, cults, governments. You're shrugging about the virus, but you're not shrugging about people who might want that virus.
The FBI guys looked even more sober than they had to start with.
Some Al-Qaeda type with a bankroll, Derek guessed. Somebody somewhere has been demanding action from his friendly local terrorist cell. Find me an infectious disease I can spread, and I'll pay you anything. And then Mitty Blake goes and writes to the world, guess what? I have some.
You're dramatizing, said Finelli.
We, said Derek, are plain old high school juniors. You are federal agents with an interest in some kid's school paper. You are the ones being dramatic. But here's my guess. What a terrorist could do is get hold of Mitty. He gets sick and they're golden. They launch the first successful bioterrorist attack on America.
Chapter 13. It was cold, but not the cold of outdoors. The chill was motionless. An unheated warehouse, maybe? But in February, a building without heat would be colder than this. Mitty thought it was around 55 degrees. Not toasty, but not lying on an ice floe, either. There was a humming sound, not the hum of a refrigerator motor or traffic on a distant turnpike, but a windy murmur. There were unpleasant smells, musty and oily, and although it was very dark, when Mitty twisted around, he could see a faint glow behind him, like a distant candle. But mostly, Mitty could not move. He could turn his head, but couldn't shrug. Could twitch his feet, but not shift his legs and arms. Could flex his fingers, but not his wrists. He was on his back, on a sagging surface, but it was not soft like a mattress. Against his cheek was plastic, not cotton. His head ached more than any headache he'd ever had. The pain wasn't behind his eyes like a regular headache, but in his left temple, in the bone. His stomach hurt, and his bladder was full. These things were minor. What mattered to Mitty Blake was that he was afraid. He was afraid in every muscle and fiber, unable to throw off his fear because he was helpless. His breathing was ragged and jerky, as if he were a little kid trying not to cry. He strained and flailed against whatever held him down. Nothing came of this. He wet his lips. He was desperately thirsty. His struggling set off a shudder that rippled through his body. He swallowed hard to keep from vomiting. It was not rope or cord holding him down. The stickiness, the straight edges, when he flexed against his bindings, must mean duct tape. Duct tape was supposed to be a joke, but it turned out to be stronger than Mitty. He was fully clothed, although without his shoes. He was lying on his back, and since there were no lumps where his pockets were, his wallet and cell phone must be gone. His watch might be under a layer of duct tape, because his right wrist felt different from his left. His iPod was definitely still in its armband. If he got the duct tape off, he had music. Mitty arched his neck to see, or at least identify, the glow behind him. It was oddly colorful, sort of blue. But his head exploded with pain when he twisted his spine. 90% of patients had severe headache. He sank back down. The humming ceased. After a moment of silence came a series of awkward clanks, like medieval armor, and then more silence, as if the world had ended and Mitty had been abandoned. His teeth were chattering. 84% of smallpox patients experienced intense shivering. Mitty wasn't gagged. He could break the silence, but he was afraid of what he would say if he did call out. He might beg. Whose silence? He thought. Who put me here? Why? The silence was awful. In New York City, did you ever hear nothing? Wasn't there always a purr of traffic and radios, machinery and people? He strained to hear voices or movement. And as if he had ordered something to happen, there was a sudden crash behind him, as if that suit of armor had fallen on a stone floor. Wrapped in his duct tape, he cringed and hated himself for it. Immediately, there was a whoosh of air. The next clank was easy to identify. Pipes. It's just a furnace, thought Mitty. An old-fashioned oil or gas furnace. Steam heat making the pipes clank. The blue light is the pilot, and the whoosh was the burner igniting. Furnaces are in basements. All these smells are basement smells. I'm alone in a basement. Immobilized with duct tape. Getting smallpox. Mitty's skin crawled. He could feel the virus forming little viral troops, gathering into viral armies and attacking the next essential organ inside him. He tried to climb past his headache and get to his memory. He had to figure out how he had gotten here. When Olivia had vanished around the curve of the path, Central Park was full of curves, first hiding and then revealing the next vista. Mitty had headed home. It wasn't fair to let his mother and father read that letter. He had to delete it and then change his plans. Mitty might not have a long life ahead of him, but they had plenty of years ahead, and how could they stand it if their son took his own life? He walked fast, as if keeping a steady rhythm led to better decisions than strolling. At Central Park West, the wide, busy street dividing the park from all the buildings on the west side, Mitty didn't wait for the walk light, but crossed in the middle of traffic, a New York skill at which he excelled. He dashed between cars, arching his body to avoid collision, waving to acknowledge honks, and pausing the exact right fraction of time to be missed by a taxi fender, all the while looking casual and leisurely. Just as he reached the far sidewalk, a woman's voice called, "Mr. Blake!" If the woman had called Mitty, he would have ignored her, since there wasn't anybody he wanted to talk to right then. But the Mr. Blake surprised him. Was his father in the neighborhood? But his dad's office was on 44th, and Mitty was now at 79th. Puzzled, Mitty turned to see a woman on the far side of Central Park West, right where he had just been, waving both arms high in the air. "Mr. Blake! Mr. Blake!" The lights changed. She got the walk light and hurried toward Mitty. Traffic relocated itself. A delivery van pulled out. A taxi pulled over. An ambulance paused. Cars whipped around them. Mitty was at a loss. Who was she? How did she know him? How come she didn't know him as Mitty? She was wearing brown, a color Mitty's mother felt should be banned. Whenever Mom saw someone wearing a brown dress, she would moan, "Somebody help that woman, please." It was a cold day, and everybody was bundled up, but this lady was wrapped to the max. High boots, long coat, gloves, a knitted scarf and a hat. All brown. She had pulled her scarf over her nose and mouth to warm the icy air before she breathed. Literally no skin showed. She ground to a halt several feet away from Mitty. "Mr. Blake, my colleagues and I at the CDC received your emails, which were forwarded to us." "The CDC?" repeated Mitty. He took a step closer to hear her better. She stepped back, holding up her gloved hand flat to keep him at bay. "She's afraid of me," thought Mitty. "It's not likely you've contracted any illness," she said. She spoke with a peculiar sort of British accent. Twice this year, Mitty had ended up in an emergency room with a sports injury. Each time his physician had had an accent like this. "But," she said, "you have handled an inhaled lesion material. Within the last few days, this is right. It is necessary to follow up." The CDC, from Atlanta, tracked me through the park, Mitty thought. Followed me from school? Me and Olivia? At this very moment, in some remote corner of some very secure hospital, were doctors donning gowns and masks and gloves, preparing to probe and poke at Mitty Blake? Had they decided the chance of infectivity was not, after all, nil? That he was going to get smallpox? He was blind with fear. "Last Sunday," he admitted. "There is a new procedure," she said, "which allows us to test blood for buildup of virus." She gestured toward a Lincoln Town Car, the kind used by private taxi services, which was currently breaking all traffic laws as it made a U-turn. Its windows were tinted so passengers couldn't be seen. The car was too stained with the salty snow debris of winter to be sure of its color. "We are 99.9% sure this will be a fuss over nothing," she said. "But it was decided to run tests anyway. Please, we are ready for you now." The back door of the town car began to open. Mitty knew about the fight-or-flight response. Mitty would have said that he personally was a fighter and would never run. Mitty was wrong. He ran. He moved faster than he had known his legs could move, his mind shooting ahead, already deciding he should avoid the apartment. He'd zigzag toward Columbus Circle, lose the car in the crowds, head for Times Square. Mitty sucked in air, circled a baby carriage, dodged a wheelchair, threaded between a construction crew and their project. He thought, this is how the disease will spread. Me, running and breathing. Mitty Blake, hot agent, a threat to his country. Mitty stopped running. He had not gone half a block. He turned around and went back to the woman in brown. Now, in the dark of the cellar, Mitty struggled to free his hands. It wasn't an escape attempt. He needed to examine his skin. If I could get loose, he thought, I could pry off the front of the furnace and use the light of the fire to check for pox. He felt permeable, as if anything might penetrate his skin, or had. He could not free himself. Mitty stared upward. It was too dark to see the ceiling. He couldn't guess what was happening, but one thing was clear. These people expected him to get smallpox. When Mitty had turned around and walked back to the woman in brown, he had been weirdly filled with relief. Whatever came next, he didn't have to make the decisions. All responsibility would lie with the doctors. In his new, relaxed state, Mitty had thought about food. Other people often talked about priorities. Responsible people were supposed to have these. Mitty hardly ever had a priority, but now that his nightmare belonged to the CDC, he did have one. Pizza. Walking back to the town car, Mitty was starving to death. He'd have pizza delivered to his hospital room. He could actually picture his hospital room now, and it didn't seem too bad. It would be bright and light with a color television high on the wall, and his parents would be outside in the hall, waving to him through a little window in the door, telling him to be brave. He had the vague thought that if he had been in charge, he would have sent an ambulance to pick up the millennium's first smallpox victim. In fact, he'd have sent a doctor who'd been vaccinated and didn't have to hold her scarf over her mouth. There was something wrong with this picture. But Mitty didn't spend a lot of time on it. He just walked right up to the car and... They hit me, he thought, lying on his back in the cellar. They hit me in the head. I, Mitty Blake, got mugged. He was offended to have been mugged, but happy to have a good reason for a bad headache. A non-smallpox reason. Unless this was the smallpox headache he'd read about, the vicious throb no medication could soothe. Guess she wasn't with the CDC, he thought. Too bad. I have some symptoms I'd like explained. It was easy to come up with comforting possibilities. His stomach hurt because he was hungry. His head hurt because he had a concussion. He was shivering because he was cold. His back ached because the thing he was lying on sagged so badly. Mitty threw up. It was sudden and unexpected. Because he was on his back, he began to choke on his own vomit. He tried to turn sideways, but the straps of duct tape over his chest prevented it. Nearly all smallpox victims experienced nausea. The wave of vomiting stopped. The churning in his stomach continued. He spit, trying to get rid of the taste. The stink of his own vomit was making him gag again. Every ghastly symptom loomed vivid in his mind, but especially the pox themselves. Their pain, itching, pus, and stench. What had it been like to live when smallpox was rampant? When every time you turned around, somebody you knew had the pox? What had it been like to glance at your kid or your parents and see pox bursting out on their beloved bodies? Back then, you must have lived with fear the way Mitty lived with traffic. Up above him, Mitty heard an eerie slithering sound, as if viruses huge and crispy were coming alive. And then came a series of taps and thuds. Not heating pipes, more like mugs of coffee clunked down on a counter. He vomited again. This time he lacked the energy to wrench his face around. He couldn't get the vomit out of his mouth and he had to breathe. He would breathe it in. He heard scraping then, voices, feet hitting the floor. There was a snick of metal, a handle turning, then pounding on stairs and light in his eyes. People loomed over him. They were covered in pale blue garments that rustled. Their hands were gloved and their faces masked, really masked, not just little white cups over the mouth. Over the eye holes were goggles. Because I'm infectious, thought Mitty. Somebody's gloved hand sliced through the duct tape with a sharp knife. Other hands swung Mitty's feet around and lifted him to a sitting position. He was whacked on the back until he coughed. Something cool and plastic was pressed against his cheek, and a stick-like thing was inserted in his mouth. Mitty sucked on the straw. The cold water took away the worst of the taste. He felt as if he could never swallow enough water to take away his terrible thirst. The hands holding him were large and very strong, definitely male and slimy, as if attached to a reptile. Mitty's head fell to his chest, a position that relieved his headache a little. He closed his eyes for a while. When he opened them again, he found himself sitting 6 inches off the floor on a camp cot, the cheap aluminum kind that folds up and gets tossed into the car trunk or the attic. His jailers straightened up. When the throbbing in his temples was under control, Mitty looked up at them. The masks were not hospital issue. They were knitted ski masks. The slimy feeling had been from disposable gloves. The men were now holding their gloved hands in the air. They high-fived each other and laughed deep, satisfied chuckles. These people were happy that Mitty was sick. Tentatively, he brought his own hands into his lap. He couldn't see well. What had seemed like blinding light was in fact dim. He squinted to be sure there were no blisters on the backs or the palms of his hands, but it was still too early for blisters. First came the little freckles, the macules. They hauled him to his feet and walked him across the cellar. Standing cleared Mitty's head, and the cement floor chilled the bottoms of his feet, which also helped. He was glad he'd worn socks today, or yesterday, or whenever this had happened. And maybe because he was vertical, not slumped on sagging vinyl, his backache disappeared. In front of him, barely visible because of the shadows he and the two men cast, was a sort of wooden stage, or ledge, with an old-fashioned washtub and a faucet. One of the men turned on the faucet for Mitty. The splash of water was beautiful, but Mitty had spotted an ancient, rusty toilet. It was not exactly in a closet, but sort of behind a board. It looked connected to plumbing, so he used it. They watched. Mitty stumbled back to the washtub, put his face under the faucet, gasped at how cold the water was, and sluiced the vomit off his face and neck. The icy water diminished his headache. The men were whispering, but he couldn't understand what they were saying. Either they weren't speaking English or his brain wasn't functioning. So, if these guys aren't the CDC, he thought, and if I'm not a patient but a prisoner, and if they're wearing ski masks and celebrating because their prisoner has smallpox. An ancient cake of soap, withered and split, lay in a little hollow on the rim of the washtub. Mitty picked the soap up, thinking that since his shirt was soaked with vomit, he'd peel it off and wash it under this faucet. And then he thought, I'm in a basement with bioterrorists, and I'm doing laundry? He whipped around, throwing soap and water into their faces. He had the one step-up advantage of the little stage, and he used it. He jumped one guy with his entire weight and knocked him down, kicked the other guy between the legs, and just as the first one got to his feet, socked him in the face. Their grunts of pain were satisfying. But they recovered immediately, encasing him in arms so strong, Mitty figured these men had been in prison for years, spending every waking minute lifting weights. They actually tossed him through the air into the remains of workshop shelving. A sharp edge caught his face and ripped open his cheek. He hit the floor, cracking his kneecap, and lost a second staggering to his feet. Then he was up, and after them to fight on. But they were leaving. Not just leaving. They were tearing up the cellar stairs. They reached the top before Mitty could get to the bottom, and then they slammed the door on him. He took the stairs two at a time, hoping to grab the knob before they could lock it. But the door had locked automatically the moment they shut it. They hadn't needed to find a key, or even flip a deadbolt. Mitty tried to turn the knob about 100 times before he accepted that this wasn't going to accomplish anything. He felt along the edges of the door frame. There weren't hinges on his side, so he couldn't dismantle it. And since the door was metal, he wasn't putting a fist through it anytime soon. There was a keyhole, but Mitty had a real shortage of keys. Through the door he heard that slithering rustle, then footsteps, then nothing. They didn't even talk about it, thought Mitty. They didn't swear or kick the door or anything. The rustling could be from that blue paper clothing, which must be disposable, protective gowns of some kind. Mitty put his hand up to his cheek. The wound was, in fact, the kind Mr. Lynch said gave you lockjaw. Mitty figured he had more to worry about than needing a tetanus booster. He sat down on the top step and leaned against the door, hoping to hear something through the crack. The light was a single bulb in a single socket, screwed to a wooden rafter. It had a short metal pull chain. The bulb was probably about 25 watts. Why would anybody even manufacture a 25-watt bulb? It didn't actually light the cellar. It just made the shadows less thick. Mitty peeled duct tape off his watch. It was now 10 a.m. on Wednesday, February 11. He would have been in the park with Olivia around 4 p.m. the day before. His parents must be crazy with worry. Mitty was a little worried himself. 18 hours, even for a sleep lover like Mitty, was a bunch of time to be out cold. The stairs were open wooden treads, never painted, and the cement floor was cracked and stained. Cement had been roughly troweled onto the walls, which were covered with active spider webs. The old gas furnace was close to the far wall, with the stairs coming down the middle of the one-room cellar, and the washtub ledge at the other end. There were black pipes, copper pipes, wiring, the water heater, the electrical panel, a few vertical 2x4s that had once held shelves. No window, not even the little eyebrow kind sunk in a pit below the pavement. No bulkhead door. Mitty had been stored in an empty room with no window, no exit, no phone, no food, no weapon, no tool. He eased himself down the stairs and circled the furnace. Then he walked back and forth, staring up between every set of rafters. There was nothing to use as a weapon. No hammer had been carelessly left hanging by its claws from a nail. There were no shelves to rip off and have himself a nice splintery sword. One end of the cellar had been remodeled, and something had been cemented over. The walls and floor here were filthy. Mitty dragged his hand through the filth and rubbed it between his fingers. Black dust. Long ago had this place been heated by coal and had a coal chute? He didn't have a pickaxe, so he couldn't smash the layer of cement and crawl out the old chute. He recognized with satisfaction the fat black cable of television. He hung on the wire until it snapped, and then he hauled it in. Nobody yelled when they lost their show. Nobody came storming down the stairs. Mitty spooled the cord into a neat circle. He found a nice dark place to hang it, and it looked good there. He could tie people up with that, assuming they came downstairs one at a time, and lay still. I could break a pipe, he thought. Use that for a weapon. Copper broke easily. Mitty started swinging like an ape from the copper pipe nearest him. Nothing happened right away, but it would work eventually. The light bulb went out. It was not the flickering finish of a burning out bulb. Somebody had flipped a switch, presumably upstairs. He considered pulling the little chain to see if he could control the light from down here, but decided to stay in the dark. They surely were watching him, though he hadn't figured out how. The ceiling was open, rafters pierced by electric wires and the pipes for heat and waste and water. So there was a lot of stuff hanging around and threaded through beams. There could be some high-tech minicam, and he supposed they might even be able to see him in the dark, but they couldn't see him everywhere, from every angle. He would think about that later. Right now, he needed to sort out this situation. There had to be at least 3 people, the woman, whoever had slugged him, and the driver. The last 2 could be the guys keeping him prisoner, but he couldn't be sure. So they had read one of his emails. It could have been forwarded once or dozens of times. Maybe he'd been online with them. Once they'd analyzed straf.edu and found St. Raphael's homepage, they'd have faculty names, office phone numbers, and, of course, the school's street address. That woman could easily have pretended to be a parent. She could have coaxed the admissions office to let her browse through her yearbook until she figured out who M. Black was. A person willing to kidnap off the streets of the Upper West Side would not be shy about lying to staff or doing anything else it took. Then they could just park, he supposed, and watch kids pour out the front doors when school ended. But how did they know it was urgent to get Mitty right away? How could they figure out that Mitty was on the brink of smallpox and there was no time to lose? From me, he thought. I said in my messages that I just found the scabs. I even told the scab collector what day I found them. Derek had said that terrorists would be online all the time, trolling for information, scouting out possibilities. They would have their computers set up so that a keyword, say smallpox, would trigger their attention. You're right, Derek, thought Mitty. It is all out there. I was too bird-brained to add 2 and 2 and get 4. I'm not even as smart as a bird. Birds can migrate. I can't get out of a cellar. So, once these guys knew the scabs were in New York, they had, say, 24 hours to plan. They could already have been in town, since New York is the target for terrorists. Okay, their plan. First, find a place to keep a hostage. Except I bet I'm not a hostage. A hostage is a person you plan to give back. Then what? Nobody, not even the most eager terrorist, could be ready for an event like this. Nobody would have a facility prepared, doctors on call, laboratory experts, airborne disease experts, creepy people willing to get infected so they can infect others. They just have to do the best they could in the short time they had. Finding Mitty, having a non-entity in Brown flag him down, that had been their best. But this cellar, it was hard to tell if this was their best, because Mitty didn't know the plan. It was small, the furnace was old, and the water heater was not going to supply more than one shower at a time. Presumably there was an equally small building above him. Probably not much of a building either, because everything down here was old and dated and wouldn't meet code. The outer boroughs of New York had tons of small houses. Row houses, two families, that kind of thing. Some nice, some slums. But whether Mitty was still in New York, or whether he'd been moved across state lines, who knew? In the dark, he felt his way to the stage and the washtub with its faucet, peeled his shirt off, rinsed out the shirt, and put his face under the faucet. With a pathetic little bar of soap, he scrubbed out the wound. It hurt. He went back to the furnace without difficulty, because of the blue glow, and hung his shirt to dry on a pipe. I don't feel as sick anymore, he thought. I hurt in some places, but I don't feel like I'm going to throw up. What does that mean? Can a person throw up from fear? Would that person be me? Or did they give me a drug and my stomach was getting rid of it? Was my headache bad enough to make me throw up like a migraine? What are the symptoms of concussion anyway? He knew what he was doing. He was still trying to pretend it wasn't smallpox. Wednesday was a long day, but Mitty had had practice at long days. He attended school. He had hundreds of songs on his iPod. Might as well play them. Mitty sang along and then, to get some exercise, danced as well. He listened to Clutch and The Darkness, to Def Leppard and Aerosmith, and Widespread Panic. He heard nothing upstairs. Maybe these guys had regular jobs and were out selling lottery tickets in some dingy little corner store, or for all Mitty knew, stocks and bonds on Wall Street. He wondered if they'd give him food. Why bother? Mitty was a well-fed guy. He could go 24, 48, 64 hours without food. And as for water, he had a tap. He considered his options. Once he broke off a pipe, next time these guys came down, he'd wallop them in the head and... Mitty ceased to breathe. His eyes dried up, frozen like the pointer on a crashed screen. These guys are doing what I need them to do. Keeping me away from innocent people. Keeping people safe. My people. I can't even let anybody rescue me. I have to stay here. Chapter 14.
Derek, you think Mitty is missing because somebody took him? Olivia whispered. Kidnapped him? Because they want his virus?
Derek loved how she asked him instead of the FBI or the CDC. He nodded.
Then he didn't kill himself, she said, sagging with relief.